Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, it is our annual Spring Bird Show. No, this isn't an April Fool's joke coming to you a couple of days late. Under all that snow out there, there are signs of spring, we promise. And dozens of species of birds are flying back or through Vermont. Here to guide us this hour is one of our favorite guests, the bird diva, Bridget Butler. She leads bird walks and gatherings across the region, and she is also the executive director of the Friends of Northern Lake Champlain. It's a nonprofit working to reduce water pollution from runoff. Bridget, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, good to be here, Michaela.
Oh, so glad that you braved the snow to join us.
With nothing would hold me back. It would have to be a super blizzard.
That's why we call you our favorite. We should also note for transparency that Vermont Public is partnering with Bridget this spring to host a series of slow birding events
around Vermont.
Oh my gosh. I know.
The news just dropped today. It's so exciting. In the out there newsletter, right? We've announced these four events. Isle of Mott. Where else are we going to be? We're going to be in the Mad River Valley. We're going to be up near Newport at Eagle Point, and then down near Springfield and Herrick's Cove doing some slow birding events. Can't wait to see folks for those.
Mm. It's going to be great. And so, yes, you might see promotions for those on other parts of Vermont Public. All right, Bridget, it is really snowy out there. Let's start with the happy birds. What birds out there are like, this is cool, I got this?
Crows. Crows are like, whatever. I saw some on my way down. They're like, this is cool, I got this. Red-tailed hawks, you know, they might push out into some areas where there may not be as much snow cover. It'll make it a little bit more challenging for them today. I saw bluebirds on my way down here, like 8 or 9 bluebirds. I'll just like kicking it in the sumac, just being like, all right, this is what we're going to eat today. It's all right. We got this. I heard song sparrow at my house this morning, which is like definitely a sign of spring. And I did, as I was out getting the snow off my car, I like shouted out to him and I was like, hey, I hear you. Hang in there. It's going to be all right. Kind of thing.
Yeah. Kicking it in the sumac would be a great rap album.
Totally.
Yeah.
Or a band name.
Mm-hmm. Mm. All right. We'll think about it. All right. So crows are happy. Some other guys doing well.
Yeah.
What about the early spring migrants? What do they do during snowstorms like today?
Yeah, this is where I think our early spring migrants are pretty hardy because, right, I remember as a kid getting to Easter and being like, there could still be a snowstorm. Or even Mother's Day. We've had snowstorms on Mother's Day. So those birds that arrive back early are hardy, right? I think of like American woodcock. They put up with a lot, especially on days like today. Eastern phoebes are back. That's a little bit rougher for our friends that are flycatchers because they are reliant on insects to eat. But you got to remember there's like little insects like stoneflies and mayflies even coming off of winter streams. So there is still food out there for them available. So the ones that are back really early are hardy. They're used to this. We're not in that place yet where we have migrants that it's going to be a little bit harder on, like the warblers, some of the other flycatchers and such. Ducks are loving it right now. They're like, whatever, this is good. We got this. As long as we got a little bit of open water, we can work our way through the slushy water. But for the most part, most of the early spring migrants that are back already are used to this type of weather.
Okay. Well, you mentioned American woodcocks.
Yeah.
Now, they have a very unique mating dance. I'm hoping you can describe for us. And tell me if they can dance in the snow. Have you seen it?
So they can dance in the snow. I wish I could do the interpretive dance for you here, like the whole like boogie wiggle. I think if most people have maybe seen this before online, you can Google it really easy. Put woodcock dance. They do this kind of shuffling thing on the ground where it looks like they're taking one step at a time and kind of bobbing their body back and forth. But then what's starting to happen at the end of the day, they're back early to set up their breeding territories. Mm. And so they're calling. That's that ping, ping, that you'll hear in open fields sounds like a frog. You're like, wow, the frogs are awake really early, but it's probably a woodcock. So they're down on the ground painting as we get toward the end of the day. And then right as dusk comes in, they're going to do these aerial displays where they go up in the sky and they loop around a couple times. And then it looks like they're almost falling out of the sky. And there's a twittering sound that they make with their vocal cords. But there's also a sound that happens from the air kind of going over their wings as well. And so that helps other woodcocks in the area kind of see and focus on where they are within that landscape. So I don't think snow is going to hamper them too much. They are going to like to hang out in fields around those places where there are some seeps, those wet areas that are going to stay wet even with a little bit of snowfall. And they like fields that have that type of poplar forest nearby, because that will be their breeding area where they'll be nesting as we get further into the spring. So I don't think so much challenge for them in terms of the snow cover, unless it gets really super icy and the ground gets covered up. Because once we go into ice and they can't access the ground, that's where their food source is. So they're going after earthworms and grubs and things like that in the ground. That's where it could become a little bit more challenging.
Well, we got an email question involving woodcocks and killdeer, I want to ask you, from a listener named Dean, who writes, "For many years, we have had woodcock and killdeer around our place. This year, no woodcock have returned, and a killdeer showed up one day and then has not been seen or heard from since. Have we perhaps seen the last of these neighbors? What is the status of their populations in the Champlain Valley?"
Yeah, I think these birds are in good shape still, right? There's lots of habitat available for them. There's not a lot of habitat conversion that's happening. Both of these birds like open spaces. They both nest on the ground. Killdeer will nest in really bizarre places like the edges of parking lots or on top of the gravel-strewn school buildings. So I think their populations are in good shape. What I would ask you to pay attention to when you start to notice these shifts or changes is, what are some other things that might influence those birds pushing into another area or finding more suitable habitat? How has the habitat around your place maybe become less preferable, right? And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be that maybe there's a predator in the area that there wasn't in previous years. It could be that the ground cover has changed. So sometimes we see fields mature into forest, right? So there's that whole cycle of that shift and change from the type of grasses and things that they like to nest in and forage in, and then it just isn't the right habitat for them anymore. So those are the types of things that I would check out to see if there's some other reason why those birds may be pushed out this year.
Well, if you have questions for Bridget Butler, the Bird Diva, give us a call at 800-639-2211. A listener named Wit wrote in with the birds that they have spotted so far. Carolina wrens, pine siskins, robins, doves, and cardinals.
That's pretty awesome. Pine siskins, I'm a little jealous of those. They're related to finches, and they're like stripy finches, and they sound like little squeezy pigs when they're in the trees. They go, so if you hear squeezy pigs, you may have siskins near you still this time of year.
Or a pig
in a tree.
Let's go to the phones. We have Brian in Moncton with us. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I see a lot of falcons in Chittenden County, but I can't tell the difference in size. I know they're not kestrels because they're of the small, but could you describe the common falcons I'd see in the Burlington area and go by size, like maybe smallest to biggest?
Yeah. So we have just a set of three. Okay. So we've got American Kestrel, which is going to be the smallest. And then we'll jump up to Merlin, which I love because we have Merlins in our neighborhood in St. Albans City. And I actually saw our resident Merlin. They're back already. So just a little bit bigger than a kestrel. And then peregrine falcon is the other one. And so peregrines, we're going to want to look for them in habitats where we have like open fields juxtaposed with cliffs. So I think of down in the Addison, Vergennes area with peregrines. Up in Highgate, there's nesting peregrines. Around the Bolton area, we have nesting peregrines. And I love your comment about size. Oftentimes, it's really hard to gauge size when we see a bird on its own singularly. And so I would encourage you, when you have a sighting of another falcon, is there a way that you can widen your field of view to look for other birds in the area? So say there's like a robin or a blue jay or a crow, then you can make the comparison between falcon, that falcon that you're seeing, and maybe another common bird. And that will give you kind of a way to measure the size, right? And so I think of kestrels as, let's see, I would probably say like blue jay sized, and then I'm gonna bump up. Merlin is on the bigger side of the blue jay. Let's put kestrel on the lower side of blue jay. Blue jay might be in the middle of the two of those, and then I'm gonna bump further up and think peregrine falcons are more like crow sized in comparison, in general. So that gives me a way to measure the size of each of those birds.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the call, Brian. And happy falcon watching.
Yes.
Let's go next to Stacy in Morrisville. Stacy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I have two concerns. One is I've noticed I haven't seen any birds in the last couple years on the telephone wires. There used to be tons of them, and I haven't seen any. And the other thing is I have a lone turkey living in my woods that seems to have an injured leg, so I've been putting water and food out for him or her. And I guess that's about it. I do have a ton of birds here today because I did put bird seed out. So got all kinds that showed up today.
That is fascinating. I love that you're making observations of flocking birds and where they like to perch. So when I think of large flocks of birds that like to perch on wires, I think of birds like starlings, grackles, swallows, sometimes blackbirds, right? There's certain groups of birds that like to hang out on wires. And so again, I go back to that thinking of what else has changed on the landscape that may not make that place desirable anymore. So in some of those open areas where there might be great perches on the wires, does that mean that there's like a resident owl that's now hanging out there or another type of raptor that might be hunting very easily on those wires, right, where everybody lines up? Also, right, we're in the early stages of spring migration. And so we will start to see more birds come back. This is also a time when birds that have been holding winter flocks, right, that behavior, that social behavior of hanging out together during the winter, now they're getting the itch that's like, ooh, it's going to get competitive here, right? And I'm going to have to be like fighting with my best buddy for the best female, right, or the best territory. So those flocks are starting to break up now. So that may be another reason why you're not seeing a lot of groups of birds on wires. They're starting to feel that seasonal itch.
Interesting. All right. Well, Stacy, thank you so much for the question. I want to sneak in one other question from our listener, Dean, who wrote in. They write that a week or so ago, they think they saw a budio. Mm-hmm. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Budio. Yeah.
Okay. Budio. Chasing/harassing a falcon. Of course, the falcon quickly outpaced and outmaneuvered the budio, and this all happened quite fast.
Yes.
The budio flew off and joined another, soaring above some fields. I've never seen or heard of this before, but is it possible or even likely?
I think you need to believe what you see, right? A lot of times we wait for confirmation in a book or from an expert, but you just provided a beautiful description of what you experienced. So the Budios are a family, like a subfamily within our raptor group of birds, right? So we have Budios, we have accipiters, which are things like Cooper's hawks and sharp-shinned hawks. We have falcons, which we just talked about, right? So our Budios are our larger hawks with like those broader, wider wings. And the most common ones that people know here in Vermont are broadwing hawks and red-tailed hawks. We could also throw red-shouldered hawk in there. So my guess here is red-tailed versus some falcon. He didn't mention size, so we could go back to that and draw some of that out, right? But yeah, this time of year, those birds, right, all of a sudden we have all these raptors that have been away for the winter starting to come back. They want to establish territory. There's going to be conflicts. And so I totally think that you saw maybe a red-tailed hawk trying to just, you know, intimidate whatever Merlin or Kestrel or Peregrine was showing back up in their territory that they've held all winter. It's kind of like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to you a little bit there.
Bridget, I have some shocking news for you.
What?
A total solar eclipse is coming to Vermont on Monday. I know. Shocking.
How did I miss that?
I don't know. How are the birds going to handle this?
How are the birds? I want to make a joke that they're all going to fall out of the sky, but that's probably not a good thing to say. Yeah, I think this is going to be fascinating. You know, the last time there was an eclipse in the United States, it didn't pass through this area. So I don't think I've had an experience to be aware and notice birds during an event like this. So I think this is a really amazing opportunity to put yourself someplace where you can notice some changes. All of this ties into behaviors that are affected by the presence or absence of light. And there's whole sets of them, right? So if we think about what happens at the end of day for birds, and I think these next couple days are a really good chance for folks to kind of prime themselves and be like, okay, what's normal? Like, what's baseline for the end of the day? Who's singing? Who's roosting? Who's flying around? Who's not flying around, right? Who's displaying, like we talked about with American woodcock, right? And really get that baseline down and then pay attention on Monday to what's going to happen. I think we just talked about the American woodcock. I think that one, that species is ripe for observation, right? So this is a bird that we call crepuscular. It displays at the end of the day when it's dusk. And so that behavior is tied into light. And it only takes place during this half an hour, 45 minutes at the end of the day. And then it stops. So here we have like this start of the end of the day that's going to happen. And will woodcocks be queuing up to do those aerial displays that I just described, right? And then will they have to do it again a couple few hours later? I'm so fascinated to find out if that's going to happen. You know, other birds we can notice are really simple birds, like common birds that we get to see every day, like northern cardinal or mourning dove. The northern cardinals in my neighborhood are always the last ones to the feeder at the end of the day. And they're also one of the last ones to vocalize at the end of the day. Mourning doves roost at the end of the day. These little chunky, like gray birds, they come in sets and they'll roost together in the trees. And so there's this great opportunity to kind of think of roosting behaviors and vocalizing behaviors and the display behaviors that are affected by light, and then put ourselves in a place where we'll be able to observe that. Mm. The other piece that's really cool is that we have all this great science now to be able to use to look at some other things more in depth, like are birds going to kind of come into roost and come out of the sky, so we can use weather radar to look at that. We're also at the beginning of migration, so places that are further south to us that are in that path of totality, is that going to affect songbirds that migrate at night? Are all these little birds that are starting to make their way back up north, are they going to be like, oh, it's time to go. I'm going to take off and
start my flight.
They could
just follow the path, like right? A superhighway.
Exactly. Follow the path of totality. Just skip across. You'll be ahead of the game and set up territory anyone else. That totally could happen. And so I think there's this really wonderful opportunity for us to make some of these observations, to participate in the science through things like eBird. I know in the Out There newsletter that just went out this morning that there's mention of a NASA project about recording soundscapes to see how vocalizations from wild animals, from insects to birds to whatever, will change. Those creatures that vocalize at the end of the day or at night, are we all of a sudden going to hear a different soundscape during that time? And we can record those things and share them with scientists so they get the data to kind of see what happens on the landscape. landscape when this event occurs.
And out there is Vermont Public's email newsletter about nature and the environment. You can sign up for it at vermontpublic.org. Bridget, thank you for hyping it for us.
It's much totally appreciated. Rich. Love it.
Real quick on the eclipse, I know that bats are mammals. They're not birds, but they have wings, so I'm going to ask you about them. Do you think that, are they going to all come out for this 3 minutes of darkness?
Yeah, and that's really interesting, and maybe somebody who studies bats could call in, because I don't know what the timing is for them to come out of hibernation, right? And so are we already at that point? Are they still in it? Are they going to come out? Are they not? Good question.
We know somebody out there knows the answer to this. Give us a call at 800-639-2211 if you know what the bats will do during the eclipse. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Catherine calling from Quebec. Catherine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Okay. Well, I was just wondering what efforts are being made to prevent bird strikes on windows, because they apparently fly over cities at night, and they get very confused by the lights. And I know that I just heard on the radio that in Toronto they have a campaign to turn off your lights from, I don't know, 10 at night to 6 in the morning or something like that. And I was just wondering, and I think there's some way you can put some glaze on these big buildings at night also for in the day, some sort of glaze on the glass. I just wondered what is being done in general towards saving birds from this, because I know we lose millions of birds that way, and it just seems like there should be a lot of effort being made to stop that and some sort of engineering.
Yeah. Hey, Catherine, thank you for the question.
I don't know.
Yeah, Catherine, thank you so much. So I think there's a lot of different levels to this. So you're right that there are high numbers of birds that die each year due to window strikes, especially during migration. So one of the very first things that we can do, even right within our own neighborhoods, is turn our lights off at night. So unless you need your lights to be on all night for some reason, is try to turn your lights off as we hit the nighttime, because that's the time of day that a lot of these smaller birds are migrating. It's cooler, it's easier on the body. And so if we turn lights off, we won't be having those reflective surfaces. The other one is to keep, if you do have to have lights on, to create kind of the shading or the, I don't know, the infrastructure, whatever it is, to create the light to go downward, right? So when you have a shade or a lantern, right, is directing it downward instead of it going up. And then you did mention different treatments that we can do for glass. There are a number of different kits out there that's really interesting right now. They're like stickers that you can put on windows that create a grid-like pattern that are basically a certain distance apart, so that it does break up the reflective quality for birds migrating during the daytime. And that's another piece, or just moving around during the daytime, right? So they see the rest of the landscape reflected in the window, and that's what's causing them to think that they can move through it. When you put these little dots in a grid-like pattern, you can even do it with paint. It breaks up that reflective quality and is enough so that birds will have enough time to see it and move out of the way. I think the larger piece here is really thinking about how we can work better with architects and designers to think about how can we make glass or incorporate these types of things into glass that will be going into buildings, how we can maybe even say that's not a good idea to have that much glass that high up in a building where you're right along a migratory pathway. There are a lot of organizations that are working on this, including the National Audubon Society, the American Birding Conservancy. So lots of groups that you can search more language and resources to kind of maybe help make that change on a community level.
Well, thank you so much for the question, Catherine. Let's go next to Patricia in Brownsville. Patricia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. We have a resident porcupine here. And one day it was just on the slope up above the house, and I believe it was eating acorns, just having a good time in the sun. And along came a crow, crowing very loudly. and landed right by the tail of the porcupine, which surprised me. Still kept crowing and crowing and cawing very loudly, and then moved up to the head of the porcupine, and just right in the ears was cawing away, and soon the porcupine took off as fast as it could go back into the woods. It was really surprising.
That's amazing. Okay.
That is such a great story. I'm so happy you got to witness that.
Right, right.
So did you have a question about it? Like, what are you still wondering? What's left out there for you?
Wondered why the porcupine didn't flip its tail when the crow initially landed, and then why it did it run away.
And why was the crow so angry at the porcupine? Yeah. Was it the crow's acorns?
Right. Oh, see, that's good, right? Like, these are the, when I teach slow birding, we talk about noticing things, saying, I notice this and this. And so you notice a porcupine and a crow interacting. And then the next one that we work on kind of using as a framework is, I wonder. So Michaela just said, I wonder if the crow was frustrated that the porcupine was maybe eating a food source. Right. I wonder if this crow and porcupine have had an interaction before and the porcupine was like, no, I'm just going to stay here and keep eating and ignore you.
Classic frenemies situation.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it just got too much. You're too loud. You're too noisy. So I'm going to move on. And then I wonder if this is part of the playful nature of crows learning about boundaries with other beings and other creatures. It's kind of like, how far can I push my porcupine buddy before they do turn around with that tail and give me a little swat? There's so much in that that's just great to kind of leave out there and wonder more about. Thank you so
great.
Much
Thanks,
for that
Patricia.
Story.
I love it. So the crow very well could have just been annoying.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of being annoying.
Right? That whole corvid family does this, right? They're very curious. They're very highly intelligent. There's lots of papers out there and videos, too, online documenting crows playing with objects, playing with other, you know, pulling a cat's tail, right? Just to be a annoying, like you said, right? But that play gives them information about their surroundings. That's what that is all about.
Wow.
Cool.
That's great. Nature's younger sibling. Let's go to Bruce in Middlebury. Bruce, go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling to report a sighting. I saw yesterday six loons swimming down the river. Now, let me first just say that I live in Middlebury, but that's not where I am. I am on the northern neck of Virginia, and I have a cabin on the Cone River, C-O-A-N. And every spring, late March, April, we see loons here, and I'm hoping they're thinking about flying to Vermont.
Nice. Tell me about the direction that the Cone River flows in. Is it like, is it a north-south river-ish?
It does. It has a branch, but it feeds into the Potomac. So generally, it's a north-south river. It's a brackish river fed by both salt and fresh water. And, I guess that's it. It's very rural.
I love it.
Nothing but farmland around here.
Okay, so this is great, right? So you said, Bruce, you said the Potomac, right? And it's brackish, right? So loons do this thing during the winter where they go out to the ocean. That's where they hang out during the wintertime. That's their migration. So normally we think of migration as it's like just this north-south thing. But there are other birds that like different habitat types. So we have all these inland lake loons. They go out to the ocean where the water is going to stay open during the wintertime. Then they're going to come back to the inland lakes again. And they need these connectors to do that, which is why I asked, is the river north-south, right? Because that's like a little highway, right? And that brackish water, right, is telling you you're getting closer to fresh water. And that river can be that that pathway that those loons are going to follow as they head north or even, you know, western to get to those lakes where they're going to breed this summer. Love it.
Right. I need to tell you that it's a tidal river, so it ebbs and flows. And we've just seen them for a number of years. This family, I don't know if they're the same ones, but just reporting that they're alive and hopefully coming home to Vermont soon.
All right, give them a couple days because we still got some snow. Just hold them back for a few days and then we'll welcome them with open arms.
Thanks so much for calling, Bruce. All right, Bridget, we have a couple ID questions for you coming in. An email from Cornish, New Hampshire. Somebody wrote about a bird they saw at their feeder that was all black with a yellow beak and yellow around the eye. We think it's a Eurasian blackbird, they write. Mm. If so, what's it doing in New Hampshire?
Okay, read that again. Yellow. Okay.
Yes, all black, yellow beak, yellow around the eye. And the guess is Eurasian blackbird.
Yellow around the eye.
We could also give you some time to puzzle this
yellow
one out.
Yellow around the eye. Yeah, so here's what's interesting. When one of the, and we talked about size already earlier, one of the things that's really helpful when you share descriptions of what you're noticing is to try to get the size in there, because that's an unchanging characteristic, right? It's something that's not going to change once that bird is mature. Plumage changes. So my first instinct is to go to American goldfinch, and people are going to be like, no, it's not an American goldfinch. But my point here is that goldfinches look a certain way during the winter. They've lost all that yellow color. They're more gray tones and brown tones. And then they switch, right? As we get into the springtime, they start to molt. We get all those bright yellow tones in there. Yeah, I'm not sure what this could be. I would call the person and ask them certain questions like, can you give me an idea of what size is? Can you tell me about what the habitat is like around your house? They did say it was at the feeder, so it's a bird that may like to be getting seeds. And then the other piece that I'm thinking about, too, is I would look at our resident blackbirds like grackle and European starling and red-winged blackbird. Because they're also going through shifts where the beak change will beak color will change as well. And then you may be right. It might be a Eurasian blackbird that somehow got off course and has ended up here in Vermont.
And then you put it on eBird and 100 people and show up at your doorstep. Well, thanks so much for writing in. Okay, one more ID real quick. Yeah. Lori asks, we live on the Mequon Shore outside of Swanton. Okay, right. On the lake, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of ducks. My husband and I are debating what we're seeing. I think they're lesser scops.
Oh, no. You're going to do the scop thing to me.
And he thinks they are baffleheads. Any guidance on telling them apart which is more likely right now? All right, we have a marriage at stake, Bridget.
That's good. All right. So scop, and you heard me go, oh, God, not scop. So scop are, and it was great because you said scop or bufflehead, although you said bafflehead. I know what you're talking about. So scop have a greater and a lesser species, and they're really hard to tell apart. And even experienced birders argue about this. And where I get to is, it's a scop. Just enjoy the scop. That's where we need to be with
that.
You
gotta make a t-shirt with that.
Right. Just enjoy the scop. The bufflehead, right, is another beautiful waterfowl that has half. So if you think of the bufflehead's head is very, very round. And if we divide it into four sections like a pie, right, one of the quadrants of that pie on the head, on the upper part of the head, is all white and the rest is black, right? And so there's this technique that birders use to identify waterfowl, which is called paying attention to where's the white. There's a whole series of these great little trifold laminated pamphlets that Cornell Lab of Ornithology does, and they're called Where's the White? And it's fascinating because with waterfowl, all you have to do is pay attention to where the white patches are, and you can get to an ID. You don't have to be like going crazy with all the different colors and shapes and all of that. But if you focus on where the white is, that will get you at the ID. So if you have if we use mallard as our measuring point, a scop is going to be close to the size of a mallard. A bufflehead is going to be hugely smaller than a mallard.
Hugely smaller.
Like drastically smaller. It's like a petite little cute duck, okay? Oh. And scop are bigger. So I would encourage you to look at where's the white to see where you're looking at. I've got scop. Scop are going to have white down below.
We have the bird book out,
lower part of the body, right, that rides on the water. So if you got a long rectangle on the lower part of the body, that's a scop. I'm not going to help you with greater or lesser because I just appreciate all the scop. Right? Don't need to add any more pressure to that. And then bufflehead, they're not going to have that white patch down low. It's going to be up high on the head. All right. Good luck. Let me know how it goes.
Good luck, Lori. We're rooting for you.
No, I was just looking up the bufflehead. And so I'm going to make a little correction here because the white on the bufflehead isn't just on the head. It is on the lower part of the body, too. Oh, my gosh. We have a whole nother layer here. So if you've got a little bit of white on the lower part of body, you got to look for the white on the head. And then that'll help you clinch that ID and save your marriage.
I just never remember ahead of this show that this is the show every time that makes me laugh. Good. When I'm just trying to read a script and every time I do it. All right, I think we have a follow-up call to the crow porcupine situation. Sweet. That we heard about earlier. Greg up in Quebec has a question or a comment. Greg, go ahead.
Hi, Michaela. Yeah, I was just wondering if I know there's a lot of confusion between ravens and crows. A lot of people can't tell the difference, but there are distinct differences between the two. Aside from the raven being a fair amount larger than the crow, the raven also has a more pointed tail than the crow, which has a more fan-like tail, and the raven has a rough sort of underneath the chin. Whereas the crow, it's much smoother. And the raven also has a deeper sort of, call to it. Yes. And a cock, you know. And I was just wondering when I heard that, I know that crows can be aggressive because I've seen flocks of crows actually attack a single raven. Mm. They aren't the best of friends. But a raven is a fair size. I think that a raven would be more likely to go after a porcupine than a crow, but I might be mistaken on that.
False accusation at the crow. Was it the raven attacked the porcupine?
See, and this is another great I wonder, right? You hear the story, you wonder
absolutely.
Else. Your description of crow versus raven was right on. And I think, right, some of those things that we can start to notice more specifically are that rough on the neck, the shape of the tail, especially when they're in flight. Size is really hard. Unless they're standing next to each other, you can't tell the difference often. But I love that you were like, no, this is my wondering about this story. What about Raven? And I agree with you, right, that it could be Raven, too, that was like having it off with this porcupine. Super. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for doing that Raven call, too. That was pretty great.
So good.
Let's go to Robert in Orwell next. Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
For the last few years, we've had vultures nest in our barn on one side of the barn, and they've laid eggs and had little ones. This year, it seems as though crows or raven have dominated the barn, and they are on the top a peak on the outside, and so I was just wondering, do ravens ever hang out with crows or
the vultures?
I mean, do vultures usually hang out with ravens?
Yeah, will they tolerate the crows or the ravens? You know, because that whole family of corvids are nest robbers, meaning that they wait for either eggs to be laid or fledglings to be in the nest and they snack on them, that it's not super likely that the vultures will stick around if the ravens or the crows have set up that spot as a frequented spot. They may try to find someplace else because they don't want their nesting to be impacted this year.
Well, thanks for the call, Robert. You know, I feel like every time we have a bird show, Bridget, there's one species that kind of rises to the top, and today it's crows.
Today it's crows.
There you go.
Everybody's got a crow or a raven story.
It's very true. Well, Chris in Woodbury has a bluebird story.
Sweet.
We have had nesting bluebirds in our bluebird houses for many years in a row. Last year was the first in many that they did not return. Mm. Do I need to replace the houses, or is it just the natural cycling of things?
Yeah, could be both. So make sure you clean out your nest boxes. This time of year is great. The bluebirds are, you know, picking sites now. So if you can clean out that nest box, that'll be really good. The other thing is to try to site some other nest boxes in the area. Sometimes we get, there's competition between bird species, whether it's wrens or the tree swallows or even house sparrows, right? So you may have other birds moving in that are just a little bit more feisty than the bluebirds and kind of pushing them out of that space. Sometimes sighting some other boxes around the area will help kind of bring them back.
Mm. Well, I hope they come back. Thanks, Chris, for writing in. Mm. Dave in West Windsor has a question concerning breeding season for barred owls. Mm. Yesterday morning, they write, I was out just before dawn. I hear and see barred owls on a pretty regular basis, but this morning was something totally different. There were barred owls everywhere. I had three owls fly by me in about 5 minutes, and I could hear at least four other individuals or pairs vocalizing within about a 50-acre woodlot. It was like I had stepped into a barred owl's singles bar. My question is, when is their mating season? I assumed we were already past it. If it wasn't courtship I was witnessing, do you have any idea what was going on?
Yeah. Oh, this is great, right? And you're right. So that breeding season, right, starts in the winter, right, the late winter. So they're setting up territories. They're vocalizing a lot in February. They're going to be on eggs in March and into April. I would assume maybe they're starting to hatch now. Yeah, I think it could, what is most likely is that it's a family of owls, right? And so I'm curious if all of them looked like adults or were some of them a little bit fuzzy, right? It may even be too early for that. So is this the set of owls, like you said? Is it the singles that are the poor owls that didn't pair up, right? Oh. And they're all in the same space with one another right now. I think it could either be a family that was early, right? We've had a wonky winter. It was really warm. There weren't a lot of things that could disrupt mating. Maybe even mating happened a little bit earlier. So we have all these fledglings that are out on the land right now. Or it could be all of those poor single birds that didn't, hook up for the winter time, and they found a spot to hang out together. That could be it as well. I'm so curious if they were starting to pay attention to where they're at in terms of their plumage, especially with young birds. I've seen young. Right. When you see the pictures of the young owls, they're super fluffy. Right. And they don't have any of those adult feathers in yet. So if they were flying, they've gained those adult feathers that allow them flight. So, yeah, good question. I think those are the two options off the top of my head, not knowing the specific dates for breeding. But we should be seeing young owls on the landscape as we move further into the springtime.
And wow, what a magical experience to see that many barred owls just flying by you.
Seeing. Wow.
Let's sneak in one more call. Andrea in Plainfield is on the air. Andrea, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Andrea, and I just wanted to mention, other people might like to know, I fell in love with the Zumax. They are like a wild-growing native weed, and they are getting about half size, you know, just the size of, the second floor high.
Yep.
And they have leaves that look like palm trees, and I liked them so much when I first moved here from Germany. Because I wanted to live in California where there are palm trees.
Yes.
And, well, my fiance didn't want that. So I said, I give it a year of a try. Well, 40 years later, here I'm calling you in and telling you, Zumax are the hit for two reasons. First, they really attract birds.
Yeah.
They have these globe-like, like a...
Andrew, we only have about 30 seconds left. What is the other reason you love sumacs?
They have colorful, colorful leaves in the fall. But they attract so many birds. Right now, they're full of robins.
Yep.
Oh, wonderful.
And this is sumac. This is the one we were talking about at the top of the show. And she's really hit on this observation of noticing the connection between birds and the plants and trees that we have on the landscape. And this is where I want to plug the tree sales that are happening all over Vermont right now by your Natural Resource Conservation District. This is one of the best things that we can do for birds is restore habitat, bring some native species back to the landscape, and pick those types of trees like sumac that either have fruits or caterpillars that the birds can eat. So trees like oak, silver maple, red maple, we've got willows, dogwoods, viburnums, all of that. There's a tree sale happening near you right now. It's going to support conservation in your county. And when you get these things planted in the ground, they're going to be great food and cover for birds. Mm. Thanks, Andrea.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. And I'm glad we got to pivot here. Because I did want to make sure to ask you about your other hat that you wear as the head of the Friends of Northern Lake Champlain. Yeah. I'm curious how those like these two worlds in which you live overlap.
Yeah, they really are. There really is an overlap there. And what I'm loving about my work right now is kind of looking for those places where we can encourage the community to take part. You know, we're experiencing increased flood events. You know, Friends of Northern Lake Champlain is working on water quality. We're always looking for projects on private land and public land that are non-regulatory where we can help out and kind of improve not only the landscape, but the water quality, and birds are a hook for that. So here's the thing. When we plant trees along streams and brooks, when we restore habitat, and we make floodplains accessible to our brooks and streams and rivers, we're also creating those migratory pathways for birds like we talked about earlier with the loons. We're creating habitat where they can rest and eat. And so I encourage folks to kind of connect with their local friends group, right, or their conservation district, learn a little bit more about the tree plantings that are happening right now, the tree sales that are happening right now, and then figure out what birds are attracted to those. These places along the waterways are where the birds are finding their way back to us. And when we do good things for birds, we're also doing good things for flood resiliency, and we're doing great things for water quality as well.
Mm. Bridget Butler, the Bird Diva, thank you so much for joining us. We have a couple events coming up with you, so be sure to stay tuned for some of these slow burning events that you'll
May
be
May and
part
June,
of.
Yep, we have a bunch through Vermont Public here that I'm very excited about for slow burning. Thank
That's
you
right.
all for listening.